Hi friends, it's Beth. You've heard my voice and documentary-style storytelling, but I have other stories. It started with a boot disappearing down Wildcat Creek and led into memories, forgiveness, laughter, and all the everyday moments that make us strong or break our hearts, or both. My new podcast is called I Must Have Forgotten. It's memoir, not murder. It's about ordinary experiences that linger and remembering what I thought I'd lost. If you ever wondered whether the small moments of your life matter, they do. Come listen. The holidays traditionally sparkle with light and laughter, but in the shadow of Prohibition, they glittered with something much darker. In secret rooms, behind secure doors, and whispered passwords, ordinary people raised a glass, and some of them paid with their lives. Prohibition was enforced by what was known as the Chemist's War, where morality was weaponized and celebration turned deadly. Welcome to episode 102 at the True Crime B&B. I'm your host, Beth. We all know about the war on drugs, its unfair implementation, its failures, its destruction. But it wasn't the first time America tried to police personal choices. More than a century ago, Prohibition attempted the same thing, turning private decisions into public crimes and punishing people for choices that harmed no one but themselves. It was a crusade born of moral fervor, but it became a cautionary tale of what happens when self-appointed moral referees refuse to mind their own business. The late 19th century and the first two decades of the 20th century had seen increased activism for temperance, which means not partaking of alcohol. Although moderate intake had always been considered part of normal daily life by the majority of people, the increase in availability of distilled liquors had brought about a rise in alcohol addiction. Temperance activism had been around since the founding of the USA, mainly with Protestant evangelicals, but had increased in parallel to the women's suffrage movement, urbanization, and industrialization. More liquor meant more addiction, more domestic abuse, and more poverty. Temperance reformers saw alcohol as the enemy of progress. The era known as Prohibition lasted for 14 years, beginning with the 18th Constitutional Amendment of 1919. This amendment took effect in 1920 and outlawed alcohol within the United States by prohibiting its manufacture, sale, and transportation, including import and export. While the 18th Amendment didn't explicitly forbid consumption of alcohol, a law known as the Volstead Act was passed at the same time to facilitate enforcement of the amendment. It forbade production, sale, transportation, or possession of intoxicating liquors, which was defined as any beverage that contained over 0.5% alcoholic content. This meant that even beer or homemade wine, which wasn't banned by the amendment, were suddenly illegal. Skipping ahead to 1933, Americans had become fed up with their personal choices being criminalized, and the 21st Amendment was adopted to repeal the 18th, ending the federal prohibition. This restored states' rights to regulate alcohol, although some states remained dry for years afterwards. Kansas remained a fully dry state until 1948. Oklahoma didn't repeal its prohibition laws until 1959. Mississippi held out until 1966 and only gave in after police raided a Mardi Gras ball packed with high society, including the governor himself. Even after the repeal of statewide prohibition, all Mississippi counties remained dry by default until they specifically voted to allow it. But not until January 1, 2021, was Mississippi's drive-by default designation finally repealed. But industry still required ethanol for manufacturing purposes, fuel, and light. And ethanol is drinkable alcohol, as opposed to methanol, which is deadly. So the government went to extraordinary lengths to keep industrial ethanol out of the hands of the populace. Although as early as 1906, federal regulations required industrial alcohol to be denatured, or in other words, treated with additives so as to make it undrinkable, the reasoning behind it at that time was to separate industrial from drinkable alcohol for purposes of regulation and taxation, to allow industry to avoid paying the heavy tax on alcoholic beverages. But after the start of Prohibition, alcohol became such a black market commodity that industrial alcohol was frequently stolen or repurposed for sale by bootleggers. An article in 1925 told the story of Frances Canestrici, a 25-year-old woman working for the industrial alcohol wholesaler Olivet Distributing Company in New York in 1925. In December of that year, she was arrested with the company president and other employees in the first federal raid on a government-permitted denaturing plant. On paper, she was just a typical employee moving product for legitimate industry. In reality, she was selling that same alcohol to bootleggers on the side. Because she had access to the alcohol before it was denatured, before the government's poisons were added, bootleggers paid top dollar for it. This was pristine ethanol, chemically identical to drinkable spirits, and in a market starved for safe liquor, it was liquid gold. And the profits were staggering. Reports show she was making between $1,000 and $2,800 per day. Per day. To put that in perspective, the average American family earned about $1,500 in an entire year. Frances was pocketing more in a week than most households would see in a decade. Her story is a reminder that Prohibition didn't just breed crime. It created fortunes, especially for those willing to risk poisoning others for profit. This is why bootlegging was so enormous. To combat this bootlegging, the U.S. Treasury Department began to require harsher denaturing additives. In response, industrial alcohol began being treated with heavier additions of methanol, which is deadly wood alcohol, formaldehyde, which is used in embalming, kerosene, or lamp fuel, and quinine, which is a treatment for malaria and was chosen for its bitter flavor. Prior to Prohibition, the less harsh level of additives had been effective because there was a steady source of drinkable spirits. Once that stream had been cut off, the industrial alcohol had to be made foul. But at the same time, these additives made it extremely toxic. Bootleggers who acquired the denatured alcohol attempted to redistill the alcohol to remove the poisonous additives. But the additives were chosen specifically because they couldn't be or were very hard to remove. So bootlegged industrial alcohol was a common source of poisonings and sickness. But since liquor that was produced by home distillers in hidden stills often contained leached metals and impurities, it was not uncommon for even non-industrial spirits to sicken those who consumed it. While the goal of Prohibition supporters had naively been to usher in a new era of improved moral behavior amongst the population, they had overlooked the frontier spirit of Americans who do not like to be told what to do. Drinking did not decrease during Prohibition. In fact, according to insurance company record keeping, alcoholism in the United States increased by more than 300% during this time. Underground speakeasies sprang up practically on every corner in big cities, with 30,000 estimated in New York City alone. If you wanted a drink and knew where to look, you were always close by. Bootleggers built gangs and mobs to protect their operations of manufacturing, stealing, and smuggling illegal alcohol. And the demand only grew higher even as the national death toll rose. It was Christmas Eve, 1926, and while New York's streets glittered with holiday lights, Bellevue Hospital was drowning in chaos. Ambulances rattled up one after another, unloading men and women who had collapsed after drinking bootleg liquor. Some were delirious, thrashing against orderlies. Others whispered nonsense, their eyes clouded. One man, hallucinating, swore Santa Claus was chasing him with a baseball bat. He died shortly thereafter. Doctors quickly realized these patients weren't just drunk, they were poisoned. The liquor they'd consumed had been laced with methanol, formaldehyde, kerosene, and quinine. By midnight, more than 60 people had been admitted. 8 were already dead, and in the days that followed, dozens more would follow them. Many of those who survived were left sightless or with permanent organ damage. If Christmas Eve at Bellevue had been a nightmare, New Year's Eve was worse. As the city prepared to welcome 1927, hospitals across New York were flooded with victims of poisoned liquor. By dawn on New Year's Day, 41 more people were dead, and nearly that many lay blind or delirious in their beds. The celebrations that should have rung in hope and renewal instead echoed with the sounds of suffering and the mask of death. Doctors and nurses, already exhausted from the Christmas rush, now faced another wave of casualties, proof that the government's denaturing program was not deterring drinkers, but devastating them. The holiday season had become a grim tally of lives lost to poisoned spirits. This denaturing program came to be known as the Chemist's War. People celebrating, people out with friends, some people having their very first drink. Death did not discriminate. Over 14 years, it claimed at least 10,000 lives. 10,000. More than legal alcohol would have taken. As the casualties mounted and the futility of the naive goal became clearer, people began to speak out against prohibition and the poisoning of industrial ethanol. The chief medical examiner of New York City during the 1920s, Charles Norris, famously stated that this period was, quote, our national experiment in extermination, end quote. In 1927, a Chicago Tribune editorial commented on the fact that zealots had forced through a well-meaning but delusional amendment that was causing copious harm. Normally, no American government would engage in such business, it read. It is only in the curious fanaticism of prohibition that any means, however barbarous, are considered justified. Public opinion grew in opposition to prohibition, and more newspapers and health officials joined the chorus. The ends, unsuccessful by any measure, most certainly did not justify the means. Scaring people away from drinking did not justify poisoning those who did it anyway. This was the government's war on alcohol made flesh. Ordinary people, celebrating a holiday, a birthday, having a cocktail with dinner, and paying with their lives. By the time prohibition was repealed in 1933, over 10,000 people were dead and untold thousands were blinded or broken. This was prohibition's legacy. It didn't increase morality, only misery. At its heart, prohibition was less about public health than about moral imposition. A fervent minority believed abstinence was virtue, and they wielded the machinery of government to enforce their belief on millions who did not share it. 10,000 people died for no reason. Instead of uplifting the nation, prohibition fractured it. It turned ordinary citizens into criminals, industry into poison, and celebration into tragedy. It stands as a cautionary tale of what happens when one group's values are forced upon a diverse people. Resistance grows, needless suffering spreads, and the supposed cure becomes far worse than the disease. And if there's one lesson to carry forward, it's this. People need to mind their own business. We don't have to like everything someone else does. We can simply ignore it. Offense at someone else's private choices is not cause to make that choice illegal. History shows that when busybodies turn private choices into public crimes, The cost is always measured in human lives. And when repeal finally came in 1933, it wasn't just the end of prohibition. It was the people reclaiming their right to make their own choices. A reminder that freedom endures best when morality is left in the hands of the individual, not imposed by the state. Thanks for listening. Until next time.